So, Dave, the way it's set up right now, you're going to be landing with 3.5 gallons left in the lowest of the tanks, and the airplane's certified to run, and all of that is usable fuel. Why is it more desirable to almost certainly run a tank dry at altitude, in your opinion, than the outside chance that it's going to run dry down low?
Running out of gas in a tank down low is a life-threatening emergency. Running a tank dry at altitude is no big deal, and it actually provides you useful information that you wouldn't have had before, and it ensures that the tank that you're going to is the one that is hoarding the fuel you need for landing, and it allows you to it's the most efficient way to do it sometimes, because it shows that you're using all of the known fuel in the tank that you run dry.
Then you're talking about actually like running it to the point where we've got engine essentially stoppage, or you're talking how when you say dry, what do you mean by dry?
Well, to me, it's like if the fuel pressure warning light comes on, that's just as good as running it dry. I mean, it's like the amount that you save, it's only seconds from the time that you get the fuel pressure warning light typically until the tank actually runs dry and the engine stops. So it's like, all right, if I see that needle fluctuate, if the low pressure warning light comes on, that's my cue to switch tanks. I'm not going to save any meaningful amount of gas by waiting until it shuts down. I consider the fluctuation in the fuel pressure warning light, that's complete, and that tank is dry.
Now, are other people okay with this? I mean, around the table here, we've got a lot of experience intentionally running a tank dry at altitude. Tom?
Well, as David mentioned, there are variations with different types of engine, and I have a fair amount of experience with turbocharged and turbonormalized aircraft. I'm very hesitant in a turbocharged airplane at the altitude you would probably be flying to clear those mountains into Jackson Hole, running a tank completely dry. The fuel pump would begin to cavitate, but there would still be inertia in the compressor. You'd still be providing a huge amount of air into the cylinders. When you reestablished fuel, you might have too lean a mixture to get combustion going right away. And so in a turbonormalized airplane, you could have some you could have a real hesitation in power. It might take you some time, 5-10 seconds or more, during which time you're descending from altitude in a mountainous environment, to try to get the engine restarted. I'd just be really nervous about running a tank completely dry in a turbocharged aircraft.
So how would you handle the situation, Tom?
Well, two different things. First, I like the idea of modifying the way you're operating the engine to give you even more of a reserve. In other words, powering back to maybe 55% power, re-leaning, very aggressively leaning, lean of peak probably in a turbonormalized Cirrus, to extend your range that way. But I'm also concerned about the overall fuel strategy here. The scenario doesn't overtly state it, but it looks like the pilot's mindset going into the entire flight was, I want to have a one-hour reserve when I land. The pilot discussed having 14 gallons and burning 14 gallons of fuel, and then things got lower than that. Well, a personal minimum, such as a personal minimum is pointless if you violate it when it becomes inconvenient. And I think that I would try to have the discipline myself that even though it's more inconvenient to go back to Riverton, if I'm not going to have my 14 gallons when I get there, I'm going to go ahead at that point and make the decision and not hope that conditions don't get worse later on.
I sort of support that thinking. My concern going into Jackson is that it's a single runway operation. And this happened to me once. I was flying an airplane back. It was coming into Connecticut, and getting towards dusk, an airplane landed gear up and blocked both runways. So we weren't going to be able to land there. We weren't fuel critical. We were able to land at another airport 15 miles away, so it wasn't an issue, but it could be, particularly at a place like Jackson, where you've only got one runway. I'm okay with nibbling down a little bit below the personal minimum as long as there are options nearby, which is an airport within 10 or 15 miles that you can always get to. But this doesn't have that, so I kind of don't like the overall fuel strategy.
Yeah, I'd agree, and for a slightly different reason, and that is if you looked at how the fuel is being consumed, we're seeing less fuel at landing, and then less fuel at landing, and then less fuel at landing, and now we make a decision that suddenly those winds are just going to maintain steady for the rest of the flight, which there's nothing that make us believe that's going to be the case. So I agree with the fact that Tom said, when you set a personal minimum, you should only change that when you're sitting down at 0 knots and 1G, and you got all the time in the world to think about it, and you've decided you're more proficient, and you've decided you can now lower your personal minimums. To Tom's point, if you just do it when you're airborne because it's convenient, there's no point in making it in the first place. And so, you know, back 10 minutes, it's inconvenient. But to go into an area where we're not that confident in the fuel gauges, we're confident, where I wouldn't say we're highly confident in the accuracy of those fuel gauges, I think I'd turn around and go the 10 minutes.
The idea of personal minimums is to reduce risk, obviously. But in this case, adding another takeoff and landing at a high-altitude airport in a mountainous area increases risk. It doesn't reduce it. I would land with less fuel at my destination than the 14 gallons because in the total risk picture, it's less.
I go back to the planning phase. Because he's new to the airplane, I think I would have planned a short fuel stop. I mean, what you want to avoid talking about risk is the diversion to an airport you didn't plan to land in the mountainous terrain. So to me, it would make more sense to do just about an hour and land, and then you can move your other refueling point to just before you go into high terrain, and the whole problem goes away.
Right, and you've got that refresh of everybody for that last leg as a strategy, like plan that last leg to be a short one before you make it for the day.
Right, and I think where this pilot really puts himself in trouble is at Nebraska, at his fuel stop. I mean, he's putting in fuel with the eyedropper to have exactly 68 gallons, and it's like, an airplane flies a little bit better over gross than it does out of gas. And I would just fudge a little higher on the amount of fuel carried. Think of something else. You're really going to be a stickler for the weight. Think of something to leave behind or not take on the trip. The airplane flies better over gross than out of gas. And I'm going to err on the side of too much gas.
Yeah, I did want to say, once you made the decision to go into Jackson Hole, the fuel use strategy, I'm totally on board with Dave, and that is run that tank as low as you're comfortable. And I would say you don't necessarily have to run it dry. In this case, we can run it to the top of the descent, right? And then once you hit that descent, you know you've got enough in the right tank to do both a landing and a go-around. And I always presume that when I'm managing my fuel. I want enough fuel to get to my destination for a landing and at least one go-around.
I just had an alternative thought that very few people take advantage of, but it might be very helpful in a case like this, where you're in a weight and balance critical situation trying to maximize your load going on a family trip. It's very out of the box thinking, but you might consider shipping the ski equipment ahead commercially and then using the weight of that ski equipment that you have on board in additional fuel so that you remove the need to make this sort of decision.
Yeah, good point. And rent.
Rent
really good skis.
I'm not comfortable with the thought of operating a little over gross because of the bigger picture. Frankly, we don't have the authority to be doing that. And unfortunately, a lot of pilots, it's a trite phrase, but it's a slippery slope. You start violating some limitations, then you might be more encouraged to violate other limitations as well.
Yeah, but the whole of this is a slippery slope, and I think what you said there about it flying better slightly over gross than out of gas is relevant. And so what are we talking about here? If we're talking about 4 gallons, that can make a difference in the risk equation, and 4 gallons is not even 25 pounds. So that's the kind of fine point judgment that you're exercising in this in the first place. So that makes a certain sense to me.
And that makes a lot of sense in, you know, how are you even weighing all these people? I mean, if you're getting down, as you said, to measuring it with an eyedropper, but the scale you were using, or you're just using what you think they weighed, or that felt about this many pounds, you know, we're routinely, there's some slop in that situation. And it is, this is like the slippery slope scenario. I wanted to go back to something that was said a little earlier. How do you judge how far, especially as a newer pilot, you can move on that direction? Because gross weight of the airplane might be a fixed number, but isn't the purpose of a fuel reserve exactly for this kind of situation? You have an hour fuel reserve so that if you have extra headwinds, you can keep going and land with a legal fuel reserve. That's what a reserve is, right?
Well, I think the reserve is more for the case that Paul described. You get to your destination, and for some reason you can't use that airport, and you have to go somewhere else at that point. That's what the reserve is for. It's not to make a decision about what is happening normally. It's about the abnormal situations that might arise.
I admire Tom's self-discipline, but let's be real. It's like they ferry SR-22s to Hawaii at 50% overgross. This airplane will fly with 5 more extra gallons, and I would so much rather fly it at, you know, 30 pounds overgross than be sweating the fuel on that last leg.
I'm with Dave on that. I would rather fly an airplane with 5 more gallons, but also to Hobie's point of the planning that goes into this and having some options, having just flown an airplane across the country recently, we had to look at our fuel options, and we always had a plan B if we had a headwind, or, you know, so maybe stopping at some different places, maybe adding one more fuel stop at a safer airport might have been an option.
So my concern with that is, while I get it rationally, it's like, okay, now you're on this slippery slope, and so where do you stop? 5 gallons okay? Is 10 gallons okay? Is 15 gallons okay? I mean, you've gone beyond the guidance now, so I'm kind of with Tom. There's guidance out there. It is regulatory, by the way, and it makes some common sense. So once you start pushing yourself, well, I'm just going to plan to fly my airplane over gross, it communicates a little bit of a lack of discipline in my mind.
That slope to me is not that slippery. You know, just because I go over it, I go a little bit over it, I am not sliding down the edge. And, you know, you talk about margins being built in. The gross weight of the aircraft has a margin built in from the certification of it. And I get it. I'm being a scofflaw. I'm knowingly violating a rule, but it's like, I am doing it in the interest of safety. And so to me, I'm going to give myself a bit of a pass on that.
One of the things that's coming out of this discussion that I find the most interesting is how you, in the real world of things, work that safety equation. You know, the regulations are put there for a number of reasons, some of which are strictly for people's safety, to keep people within some constraints so they don't routinely fly their Cirrus at 4,000 pounds, say. But on the other side, there's a real argument here for, is a net overall create a potentially safer situation? I mean, by fudging a rule, if you will, in, you know, a gallon or two gallons. I want to get back to that. How do you put some constraints on yourself? What would be your recommendation for pilots who don't have a lot of experience to fall back on for how to manage that risk equation? I mean, that's really what we're talking about here.
I ran into this once, and it kind of informs the situation. I've written about this. I walked by a hangar. This was in Oxford, Connecticut. There was a pilot inside the hangar draining fuel from the wings of the airplane. I forget what it was. It might have been a Cherokee, into plastic jugs. The hangar reeked of gasoline fumes. And I think he was taking out 8 or 9 gallons because he wanted to be within legal limits. And to me, the trade-off was he's building an explosive environment in this hangar to save about 30 or 35 pounds to be legal. And the risk of taking off with 35 pounds overgross is almost infinitesimally small. You probably would have a difficult time measuring it. And as pilots, as far as the slippery slope, I agree with Dave, it's not that slippery. You have to determine every time you fly what's go and no-go for you. And you do it by reviewing the data, or you do it by gut feel. And as a pilot, you're allowed to and you're expected to say, this is far enough, this is too far. And too far will be different for everybody, and that's one of the reasons you become a pilot, because you want to make those judgments. And you might be wrong sometimes, and that sort of goes with the territory. That's what risk is.
A thought that I had would be, I think that it would also maybe depend on what kind of airplane you're putting that extra weight in. You know, is it a Cessna 150 with 100 horsepower, or a Cessna 182 that's got a little more horsepower?
Right. I mean, you've got multiple kinds of airplanes, multiple situations. And I really like what Paul brought up about, it's not a simple risk equation. And maybe there are two points on this curve. There is the what I'm willing on the net, even in flight, to say, all right, I don't like either of these situations, but I got myself here. I feel like this one is safer than that one. And there are certain points where it's like, no, that is just too far over the line, even if it means turning around, going back, landing, costs me an hour in time. And that line is going to be different for each kind of pilot.
I think there's a difference in the premeditated version of that, where I'm sitting on the ramp and decide, oh, I just don't want to make another fuel stop, so I'm going to load on more fuel and go over gross intentionally. And when you're airborne and you see I'm in a situation, I'm going to have to fly in less than what the legal reserve allows, or I'm going to have to maybe go below minimums or whatever the case is, because that truly, in fact, is the best option in front of me as it was presented, not premeditated back on the ramp.
All right. And talking about the reserves, of course, the legal reserves, there is no legal requirement once you're in the air. It's all for planning purposes. So it falls back on a personal minimum. I like to use an hour. That was the way I read the scenario. Interesting. I was thinking, however, if I were en route and I were in a situation such as described here where I really cannot accept any delay in getting on the ground when I get there, would this be a situation where if you were talking to ATC, you would declare a minimum fuel advisory? Would you actually call and tell controllers, I have a minimum fuel advisory, I cannot accept any significant delays? Would you do that here?
That doesn't seem like an unreasonable thing to do. But I mean, you're landing with 10.5 gallons. If everything goes right, that's still awfully close, but it's still above the regulatory requirement. It's certainly not an emergency in my mind.
I get your point. If you manage the fuel in the way that you describe, you're right. I just wondered if that was a consideration.
In talking about declaring minimum fuel, I mean, that's a statement to controllers, but it does not give you any priority. So if you really have an issue, you have to declare an emergency. I don't think I would declare minimum fuel unless something happened that added a delay. VFR, I wouldn't expect any delays.
Right, something that you got something in exchange for that declaration, something you needed.
That was my point, is in this scenario, I'm not sure it helps you at all. You're going VFR direct already. Weather's not a factor. There's no traffic, right? So I'm not sure it helps you any.
I was just going to say, we've all probably been in situations flying where you're sweating the fuel. There is hardly anything in flying I despise more than that, because it makes me feel so damn stupid. You know, it's like if you're sweating fuel for the last hour, that hour is going to be miserable, because that entire time you're going to be thinking about, how could I be so dumb? Why did I put myself in this situation? How is it that with all the things I've learned about flying, I'm in this situation where I'm just watching that, you know, ground speed and my time to the destination and being nervous. So, you know, anything that can be done to avoid that situation, I'm in favor of.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that to me is, you know, sort of one of the takeaways from this scenario is trapping the tempting situation out of the flight. You know, this pilot absolutely set himself up with this longer flight, a long leg at the end, trying to make it without a stop, planning a stop, having either an ironclad, like this is Jackson Hole and I don't have a lot of alternate options, so I'm definitely, no matter what, going to land with this much fuel or divert, even if it means going backwards. Any of those things could have removed the situation prevented it from starting in the first place. And then what that's going to be and what that trap is going to be different for every kind of pilot. But there were definitely ways beforehand to prevent it from happening at all.